Hi, I'm Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC. It's 38 degrees. Everyone's wearing a scarf. The Astros are in the American League. The Angels are playing the Reds. What? The Red Sox could be the worst team in their division. This must be the most unconventional start to the most conventional of sports. In this week's Sports Illustrated, Ben Ryder, on sale now, staff writer Ben Ryder and his colleagues break down the upcoming season as well as looking at other pressing questions like strikeouts. Where has the shame gone? He's here to discuss the 2013 Major League Baseball season. We'll also take some calls, your emails. Our guest is Ben Ryder. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So, look, baseball doesn't get it all wrong. I know that people who like baseball are nostalgic and they complain about every change. But as I think about the big changes that are kind of crashing into us right now, things like a one-game baseball playoff, and as I mentioned, the Reds versus Angels, the first game of the season, are any of these things, maybe some of them are necessary. Do any of them make the game better, do you think?
You know, I was a skeptic about the one-game wild card setup for a long time. When it was first announced by Commissioner Bud Selig, I thought this was a bad idea. I thought that it would dilute the meaning of the playoffs so that it would just be the hot team that happened to sneak in would win. I was wrong. I'll admit it. This has led to a very exciting end of season, all season long, actually. It's really led to a new era of parity. A lot of teams saw what the Baltimore Orioles did last year and the Oakland A's did last year, and they said, if they can do it, we think we can do it too. That's led to an incredible era of parity. If you look at the American League this year, of the 15 teams, 13 of them are legitimate playoff contenders. We can count off the Houston Astros, who are really rebuilding, probably count out the more gently rebuilding Minnesota Twins. But none of the other 13 would surprise you. That has a lot to do with the fact that there is this extra playoff spot, and anyone can make it.
That's interesting. I will concede that it has had that effect. I would, however, say that it's not really parity. What we have is a regular season where there is a correlation between the amount of money you have to spend and the quality of the club. Sure, the Yankees are a very rich team, and this year might not be their best year. But in general, richer teams do better. But then come the playoffs, and with a one-game playoff, after a 162-game season, it just injects this randomness there. Now, randomness isn't parity. Yeah, it's true. Any team can win in the one-game playoff. So, to me, it's antithetical to the sport as a whole. But I'll concede your point. Teams are incentivized to be good because all you really have to do is win 87 games, and who knows, you can win the World Series.
I agree with your point about that one-game playoff itself. I don't think that's a fair way to decide who moves on to the playoffs. Unlike football, baseball is really a long-term game. The worst team in the game, let's say the Houston Astros this year, will win 50 to 60 games of their 162.
Right.
So yes, I think that does introduce probably an unfair element of randomness. What I do think is good is the chance that it gives all these teams to, you know, try to stay in it as long as possible instead of blowing things up, waiting till next year. I think that creates a very exciting regular season, perhaps a slightly more unfair postseason.
So let's talk about the Yankees for a second, because for, you know, a decade, more than a decade, not only were they the highest spending, they were the highest spending by a huge degree. And they didn't always win the World Series, but, you know, they almost always made the playoff. Things are different now. Why?
There's one major reason, and that's the implementation of a luxury tax by Major League Baseball. Essentially, the Yankees have been incentivized to get their payroll underneath $189 million last year.
It's quite a haircut.
This will reset the luxury tax that they pay, and then it'll start escalating again. But if they do it by next year, that's going to be a big deal to them financially. So this has led them to have a very quiet offseason, and we look at the way their roster is currently constructed. A lot of aging veterans. With that age comes a lot of injury. That opening day lineup they ran out yesterday looks nothing like a Yankees lineup as we'd really imagine it. Now let's point out $189 million. That's a heck of a lot of money. That's more than three times the payroll of the Tampa Bay Rays. So they're not going to have to sacrifice too much, but they are doing business in a different way. We can get into a whole nother can of worms about whether it's right that a team that has a $1 billion stadium that was in large measure publicly constructed should be kind of exercising this budgetary stuff that they're doing right now. You know, that's another topic.
Right.
However, on the field, it does mean that the Yankees are not going to be in the situation that they have been for so long.
And their $189 million is a really, I mean, if I would just presume that if the Rays were gifted that money to spend it, they'd spend it in different ways, let's say more wisely. I mean, you have Alex Rodriguez, a player who's going to be out for, you know, half the season making $25 million, which happens to be, by the way, the Astros' entire payroll. So, yes, it's a little bit different. My question for you, though, is do you think George Steinbrenner, if he were still alive, would care about that 100, would care about the luxury tax you're talking about? Or do you think this is mostly, you can answer it two ways. What you think George would do, and is it, though, a rational economic move to get under the number?
Sure, I think it's a rational economic move. I mean, either you could needlessly spend tens and 20 million extra dollars, or you could, you know, go through one difficult year, reset that luxury tax, and then say in 2015 they'll be spending $250 million again in a kind of arm race with the Los Angeles Dodgers, the likes of which the game's never seen. That's probably what's going to happen. I talked to Brian Cashman, though, this spring a lot about this. He actually got a bit upset. You know, he said, I'll paraphrase him, "I'm tired of talking about this payroll crap. We were doing this even when George was alive." He claims that they haven't been spending as much as they had maybe in the middle part of the 2000s for the past several years, even in the last days of George Steinbrenner's life. So he would argue that, you know, this isn't a huge departure from what they used to do. To everybody else, it certainly looks like it is one, especially given that they did not make a splash at all this offseason. They saw Nick Swisher, their outfielder, go to the Cleveland Indians of all places because they wouldn't pay up for him. Certainly a change.
The Indians yanked a guy out of New York. That's never happened, especially because, you know, Steinbrenner's from Cleveland. He never wanted to let Cleveland have a leg up. How good do you think the Yankees will be? I mean, like you said, their opening lineup, you compare it to the lineup 8 years ago when Bernie Williams batted eighth. I mean, this is a player. He's not a Hall of Fame player, but he's a great player, a great offensive player. If he's eighth in your lineup, you have a killer lineup. Now they have, you know, guys like Lyle Overbay and Jason Nix. So what do you think the outlook is for them?
Well, it was official yesterday, okay? As far as their 10 leading home run hitters from last year,
yeah,
one of them was in the opening day lineup. That's Robinson Cano. Okay, so the next nine, that's more than a full lineup.
Yeah.
We're not there anymore. This isn't even a bad major league lineup. This is in some levels like a minor league caliber lineup, okay?
Of that's because of injury.
A lot of it is because of injury. Let's say that. Curtis Granderson, Mark Teixeira should both be back in a month. Alex Rodriguez, perhaps by midseason. So they should be getting some of their...
Derek Jeter in a couple weeks?
Derek Jeter, who knows? Yeah. You know, when he's that age and he's got an ankle injury, I hear he's has some trouble. He can't really run right
now. But we've been saying when he's that age for 5 years, and he's been the best shortstop in the American League, arguably.
It's going to happen eventually.
I guess.
It has to.
But so much about him doesn't actually adhere to the norms, but go ahead.
So I guess my point on the Yankees is that I thought that their difficulties in the lineup were really making people overlook what they did have on the pitching side of things. It was just simply a terrific, deep pitching staff. You know, they've got six quality starters when this guy Michael Pineda, who they traded from last year for the Mariners, who hasn't pitched yet for them because of a shoulder injury, when he comes back, they'll have seven. They have a deep bullpen with Mariano Rivera back. However, yesterday was troubling in that regard, too, because CeCe Sabathia, their ace, really couldn't throw faster than 90 miles an hour. He's coming back from a surgery of his own. This is a person who usually throws 94, 95 on average. If he's not right at the top of that pitching staff, this could be worse than even I imagined, and it could be worse than even the tabloids of New York are imagining, and that really would be something.
Yeah, CeCe Sabathia, not just the ace, but the cover boy of Sports Illustrated. Actually, there's like a dozen covers. But in New York, you can buy one on the newsstands with CeCe on the cover. Ben Reiter helped put together their baseball preview package. He's joining us on WNYC. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Leonard Lopate. Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. If you want the skinny, if maybe you're a fan of the Oakland A's or some other out-of-town club, or you want to talk about an issue in the game. So I've been promoting this question, and it is a good one. Every sport has injuries, but it seems like baseball is beset by injuries, and it seems like, you know, pitchers have become so much more fragile. What's going on?
I don't think they've become more fragile. I really don't. I think what it is that it used to be, you know, if a pitcher tore his elbow, that was it. We never see him again.
Right.
Okay, so we'd have these kind of hardy types that could go their whole careers without having any of these injuries, and they'd last. So it just seemed like they weren't getting injured, or at least many of them weren't getting re-injured again and again. Now with modern medicine and training techniques, those guys can come back. What it means as a whole is I think that the level of quality of pitching in the game is much better than it used to be when you just had these kind of, you know, guys whose elbow tendons were made of braided ropes but perhaps couldn't throw 100 miles an hour. So I think that's really the answer here. It really comes down to medicine and the ability to get people back.
Okay, so that's interesting. That would suggest that there's nothing actually different from the way pitchers are pitching. They're just we get the guys off the injury pile and out of the hospital quicker. But isn't there something about different about the way pitchers are pitching? I mean, I have read the old timers say things like, you know, back when there weren't six relievers in every game and you knew you had to go like nine innings, you would cruise here and there. There are ways to preserve your arm. Now it's just reach back and try to hit 100 or whatever your personal best is all the time. It makes strikeouts go up, but so does a change in thinking about strikeouts. But it does seem that it is now maximum effort on every pitch.
You're right about that, without a doubt. You know, in this Generation K story, we have an SI this week that I think we're going to get to in a bit. Tom Verducci, our senior baseball writer, points out that in the past 6 years, since 6 years ago, there's 133% more pitchers whose fastballs average 95 miles an hour.
Right.
That's an incredible rise. Yes, I do think that velocity is king these days. Kids in high school know that if they go out there, throw as hard as they can, doesn't matter if it's anywhere near the plate or in the next county, if a scout sees them throwing somewhere in the 90 miles an hour, they're going to get drafted. So I think that velocity has really taken over. Perhaps that's one reason why we're seeing more of these arm injuries, if people are just going all out instead of trying to conserve things. But yes, no, you're right about that point.
It's also easier to develop a guy. If you are running a minor league system and there's some guy who's reaching 98, well, you keep him no matter what. You develop him. Maybe he has very few other skills besides that. Now, another pitcher who might one day become the crafty Tom Glavine type to pick up, Greg Maddux type to pick someone who was never fast but a master at spotting his pitches and so forth. That guy won't have as long a leash in the minor league system. I wonder if baseball is doing itself a disservice by just going, you know, involving itself in this arm race and not developing, you know, smart, crafty pitchers who do things besides hit in the high 90s.
It might be doing itself a disservice, but from kind of a capitalist standpoint, it makes sense. It works, you know. To a baseball team, yes, they'd like their pitchers to stay healthy, but they really want to win and they really want to get a lot of strikeouts. And then if they can kind of cycle these guys through who can throw in the upper 90s, strike out a bunch of guys, you know, if they get hurt, they're probably going to have more in the pipeline. You know, it's not very nice.
Right.
You know, it's not really showing a lot of concern for the overall health of their employees.
Yeah.
But it gets results, and what matters.
This is why they call pitchers arms, as they're not real people.
A bit dehumanized. That's
yeah.
Right.
And now strikeouts are going up because of everything we've been talking about, which is velocity. But also, there's just no stigma to striking out anymore. Was it Verducci's story where he talked about Lou Brock not wanting to get 100 strikeouts in a year and asked to be seated in the last game of the season so he wouldn't have that scarlet letter or number around his neck? Something like 100 strikeouts is nothing anymore.
That's right. No, it was Lou Brock had 99 strikeouts. This is the Hall of Famer. Begged out of the game. So, yeah, he wouldn't have the scarlet letter on his jersey. Now 100 strikeouts is nothing, as you said. You know, let's look back. That great quote from the movie Bull Durham. You know, Crash Davis says to Nuke LaLoosh, "Don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring, and besides that, they're fascist.
Yeah.
Throw some ground balls. It's more democratic." Well, fascism reigns in baseball these days, at least as far as the strikeout. Let me just give you some stats here that we have in our baseball preview issue. Okay, last year, there was a record number of strikeouts across Major League Baseball for a fifth consecutive year. That's five records in a row.
Right.
Not only do we set a record, but the increase from last year, the season before, was 5.6%. That's huge, okay? Adam Dunn had 222 strikeouts last year. That's one off the all-time record. In a league in which 100 was once a mark of shame. This one is the most amazing one to me. This is unearthed by Tom Verducci. Between 1901 and 1967, a total of 110 players struck out 100 times in a season.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, last year alone, 111 players struck out 100 times. Okay, That's just an unbelievable.
So 1 year equals the first. Was it 60 years?
1901 to 1967. And all those years combined, 110 players struck out 100 times. There were 110 seasons.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Last year, 111 in one season alone. I mean, that's basically, I mean, if you want to try and put this strikeout trend in context, that's the one that really does it for me.
Okay, so there are two questions. The first is, strategically, who's right? The guys who didn't want to strike out, or the current thinking, which is, you know, strikeouts are okay if every once in a while you get a home run out of it?
You know, obviously, baseball, the understanding of statistics and kind of the underlying stats in the game has the understanding, the widespread understanding of this stuff has exploded, okay? So it's no coincidence. It used to be a mark of shame, as we said, to strike out. Now people understand that it's really not that big a deal, okay? Remember how in Little League, Mike, we used to choke up on strike three?
Yeah, yeah.
Make sure we don't whiff?
Shorten your swing.
Shorten your swing.
Yeah.
Nobody does that anymore, okay?
Because you're giving away, if you're Jim Tomei or if you're one of these strikeout machines, you're giving away the greatest asset you bring, which is the ability to crush a ball over the fence.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, nobody, if you choke up, say you hit a little tapper to the shortstop, it's a ground out, maybe you advance the runner, it doesn't matter. You know, statistics tell us that result is really not a good result. The good result would be, you know, grip the bottom of the bat, let it rip. You'll probably strike out a lot. But you're also going to hit some doubles, some triples, and some home runs on that third strike.
And a lot of these egregious strikers outers like Adam Dunn, mm-hmm. they're good at walking.
Yes.
And it used to be that no one really cared about a walk. It was just seen as some byproduct of the game. In fact, when Henry Chadwick invented the game, he kind of looked at the walk as, well, you got to do something if the pitcher can't find the plate. But, you know, this is why it doesn't even affect average. But now walks are really, really prized.
They really are. You know, getting on base, a walk is obviously much better than a sacrifice ground out.
Right.
You know, people used to think if you move that runner over, you know, great job, you're moving closer to the ultimate goal. No, in the long run, statistics show that that really does not give you much of an advantage at all, as people had thought it did for the game's first century or so of existence.
So there's one thing that we were told in Little League, choke up on the third swing, that isn't true. But that's another thing in Little League we were told that is true, when they used to say, come on, walk's as good as a hit. And you would think, no, it's not. Who wants to walk? But a walk is pretty much as good as a hit. Let's take a call. We have Henry from Brooklyn is calling in. Our number is 212-433-9692. Hello, Henry.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
My argument is that for the last, 70 years, nobody's managed to hit above 400.
That's true.
And I lived with baseball all my life because I had a brother named Walter Lapp, who was a statistician, worked with Jim Bouton. And in a book that he wrote in the foreword of the book, he spells out what batters, managers need to do, and it's to get people who are people who are engineers and
physicists
to get involved in it. And why it's not happening is beyond me, because with Little League you have people who are iron workers showing you part time how to hit the ball. The thing needs something that deals with science, because it is a science. Hitting a ball with a cylinder is absolutely science, and the swinging of a man's bat is, you can have it down to such a slow motion that you can see the tears in his eyes. So
yep.
What's with that?
That's the good question, and we'll be talking with Ben Ryder of Sports Illustrated a little more after the break about some of the innovations, including cutting-edge science stuff. Our number is 212-433-9692. We'll be back in a minute. Hi, I'm Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, talking about the upcoming baseball season with Ben Ryder of Sports Illustrated. He previewed a bunch of teams for their baseball preview issue. Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. WMYC. Also, tweet us at Leonard Lopate. Find us on Facebook, all that. So I want to get to the Mets in a second. I want to get to some of the other teams that you visited. Maybe I'll ask you for an interesting team we haven't thought of. But Henry from Brooklyn just gave a call. He said, what about technology in baseball? You know, why are some old tobacco-chewing cusses doing the instruction? Shouldn't it be a physicist? And with the statistical revolution, there's also been an acknowledgement and embracing of a lot of modern science. I did a story on Rick Peterson, who really believes in getting pitchers into these machines where you could see them and kind of trying to diagnose what injuries they might have. He works with Dr. James Andrews in Alabama. What else about the cutting edge is taking place in baseball?
Well, Henry pointed out how long it's been since anyone's hit 400.
Yeah.
And there's a number of reasons for that. And there's a number of reasons why, unless something major happens, we're never going to see a 400 hitter again. Let's remember that hitting is a reactive discipline, okay? The pitcher's in control, the defense is in control, the hitters are reacting. Now, modern science and modern ways of analyzing the game has really given pitchers and defenses a real leg up. One of the major ways is in terms of defensive positioning, okay? Teams can analyze spray charts, they're called, okay, where hitters tend to hit the ball, even against certain types of pitchers. Say a lefty pitcher who with a good breaking ball, where's this guy going to hit it? Okay, they're going to see a chart of exactly that. A great person, one of the preeminent guys in this field is Joe Maddon, the manager of the Tampa Bay Rays. If you watch a Rays game, he's shifting his defenders all over the place. You know, he's against a pull hitter, he'll put them all on one side of the field. There's nowhere for these guys to hit the ball, you know? If they change the way they're trying to hit, they're not going to have success anyway. So that's a big part of it. Another big part of it is what we were talking about before with just these 95-mile-an-hour after 95-mile-an-hour arms coming out of the bullpen. It's not the type of situation that we used to have where a guy would be in for the whole game, a hitter could get used to him, the pitcher mm-hmm. would get tired. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen anymore. And another thing is when we talk about statistical information, it's that pitchers are so better armed with statistical information about hitters' weaknesses these days. Not just where they're going to hit the ball, but where their weak spots are. You know, you're going to get a scouting report before the game, and you're going to see that if you throw him a breaking ball down and inside, he's hitting 100 against that pitch. Those things are constantly being refined. So the advantage is kind of tipping more and more in favor of the pitcher and in favor of the defense.
Why would that advantage the pitcher? I mean, wouldn't batters be able to know more about pitchers?
No, as I said, batters are reacting. You know, yeah. It's kind of like pitchers always have the first move here. So, yes, hitters do know more about pitchers, obviously, but it's much easier to attack in that way than it is to defend. And as Henry said, try and hit a tiny ball moving at 98 miles an hour with a cylinder of wood.
Yeah, try to hit a round ball with a round bat square. That's the hard thing. What about the idea that batters shouldn't think too much? Derek Jeter, who is a great player, he never thinks. He's just really instinctive and reactive. He's a thoughtful guy. He's not stupid at all. But that is his approach. It's totally worked for him. How come people don't say that with, well, I guess people say that with really young pitchers. You can't load their head with information. But why is it okay to load the pitchers up with this stuff, but, you know, not the batters?
I think Derek Jeter probably thinks just a bit more than he lets
yeah,
on
right?
publicly.
Helps him get those car endorsement deals. I don't know. I'm just playing the game.
Yeah. Okay. You know, when a guy has been in New York for 17 years or whatever it is at this point and has done as well as he has, as beloved as he has without a hint of controversy, he's obviously pretty savvy. Okay?
Yeah.
So he's
yeah.
probably one of the savviest guys out there. I think you have to think. You can't just react. You can't react to it. You can't go up facing a 98-mile-an-hour fastball and react and think you're going to do anything, especially not when, as we said, the pitchers are so loaded with information about you. It just doesn't work that way. And you have to think, really. You know, in the preview issue, we talk about a real revolution that came about in the form of Greg Maddux, the four-time Cy Young Award winner in the National League. He pioneered something called the scissor effect as far as the way that pitchers approach batters. It used to be that, you know, a right-handed batter against a right-handed pitcher, you'd basically know where the ball's going. The pitcher's going to pitch to the outside half of the plate, so that basically takes a 24-inch wide home plate, turns it into 12 inches. You could zero in on that zone. What Maddux really did, he didn't throw very hard, but what he really did is he discovered a pitch called the cut fastball, okay, mm-hmm. the cutter. This is a thing that looks like any other pitch, but all of a sudden it's running in at the hands of right-handed batter, which is something that you were never supposed to throw before, but with this pitch you can. Lots of other pitchers have, following Greg Maddux, have picked up on this thing. All of a sudden hitters have twice as much ground to cover. They can't tell what pitch is coming. That's another reason why the game is tilting in the advantage of the pitcher.
And Mariano Rivera, the great Yankees closer, is going to ride his bat splintering cut fastball to the Hall of Fame. Ellen from Park Slope, welcome.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I want to get back to a point you two discussed earlier, that of the growing number of strikeouts.
Yes.
And the increased acceptance of walking.
Right.
And it seems to me that these two things complete the evolution of baseball as a game made for TV rather than a game made to play in the stadium, because a lot of the subtleties of the pitcher's mechanics and the movement of the ball can best be seen on a screen rather than in person. And I wanted to know what you thought about that, and also what can we do to make, or what can be done, to make the game more exciting to watch in person. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. We'll give you our answer on the air. What do you think? Because I know Verducci says that walks are kind of unexciting. They take a long time, and the guy just walks afterwards.
That's a really smart point.
Yeah.
About the way that it does benefit TV. Obviously, especially with all the angles that we have now, high definition, not just slow-mo, but super slow-mo, we really can see the way that the ball is moving. That does make strikeouts a bit more interesting. I'd argue that even on TV, they're not that interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a problem for Major League Baseball. It's a smart thing for teams to do. Obviously, we've seen that they can have success with it, and they've figured this out. However, it makes the product boring. Nearly 30% of plate appearances last year ended without a ball being put in play. People don't watch sporting events to watch people go walk up to the plate, walk back. They want to see people
run. It's really
run.
Two guys having a catch.
Right. Yeah. They don't want to see that. They want to see people run. They want to see people hit the ball.
Yeah.
They want to see stolen bases.
Yeah.
None of that is happening to an increasing degree in the game today. I think it's a problem, That ratio of how many at-bats end without anything really happening rises later in the games. What's supposed to be the most exciting part of the game, the late innings. People are drawing walks or they're striking out. They're taking 10 pitch at bats without any satisfying result. I agree that it's a problem for the game. It's kind of like, remember that era in men's tennis at Wimbledon when all of a sudden guys like Pete Sampras and Goran Ivanišević were just hitting ace after ace after ace after ace. Unlike in tennis, though, you can't really soften the baseball. That wouldn't really work as far as strikeouts anyway, because you're not touching the ball anyway.
Raise the mound, move it closer. My solution is the one that's glaring baseball in the face, and it's some version of a shot clock between pitches. And these guys who walk out. I love David Wright, one of my favorite players. I have no criticism of him, except he readjusts his batting gloves after every pitch, and there's no reason to do it. Mm-hmm. And at-bats take so long, and some leagues have tried to just speed it up a little bit, and there might be a little pushback. It's not been done before. Baseball's traditional. But if you could get, instead of 30 seconds between pitches, it down to 22, it would make the game so much better. What do you think?
Well, if that's what you want, you got to see this new Red Sox prospect, Jackie Bradley Jr., who's one of the big stories of spring. Very exciting young player, made the team when nobody thought he was ready yet, but he hit about 450 during spring training, didn't give him much choice. This guy never steps out of the box, okay?
Yeah.
So that's another reason to be excited about him.
I don't know if you can see what's up on my screen, but it's Jackie Bradley Jr., because I was trying to find the guy. They said a statistic about him that he saw more pitches in his debut than any other person since. How do they even know that? That's the craziest statistic.
Well, they know everything.
Right, they do, and that's some of what we're talking about. And that is prized, seeing pitches. That was just something that was seen as, a boring byproduct of a game that wasn't good. But now seeing a lot of pitches, we realize that's something maybe that is good for a batter to do that could tire the opponents out. It was said that when the Yankees were great, that was one of their big skills. They would see a lot of pitches.
Right. As we say, again, it's these kind of two warring factors here. It's a positive thing as far as winning a game, but it's boring as far as its entertainment factor, right? My problem isn't so much, this is my personal opinion,
yes.
My problem isn't so much the length of the game. When the Yankees play the Red Sox, it's going to be 4 hours. You expect that. I think more of a problem is what happens when you break the game up into its at-bats, whereas it takes a long time for very little to happen a lot, and that's what baseball is going to have to address. I'm not sure. That was another part of the question. You know, I'm not sure what we're going to do. Are we going to lower the mound again, you know, like, you know, 4 decades after we last did it?
Right.
I don't know if we can move the mound back, but, you know, it's very hard. It's a very hard question.
Earlier you noted that 13 of the 15 AL teams have a decent shot at the playoffs. It's not quite that high in the NL, no. And I would say the Mets are not one of those. Would you agree?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is a major, major rebuilding season for the Mets. It's part of a rebuilding effort. They should have a pretty good pitching staff, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, talk and about a young staff, which is good, with guys like Matt exciting. Harvey and David and Dylan Gee.
And yeah. we're going to see Zach Wheeler, who's one of the top 10 prospects in the game, is at least universally acknowledged as such. So, you know, that's going to be exciting. You know, that'll show some reason for optimism. But beyond David Wright, it's going to be a struggle offensively. I guess, you know, today they're 1-0, so, you know, maybe you can keep some of that optimism.
Right.
This team's built for the future.
Got to have more Cowgill. And finally, we have a minute left.
Okay.
Talk about a team that we haven't thought of that has something interesting going on there.
Let's look at the Oakland A's, okay?
Let's do it.
I'm going to say, obviously, the A's were a surprise team last year. I'm not going to say that they're going to be surprised and that they're again going to come out of nowhere because they won the AL West. The surprise is that they've again come upon this model that can be repeated, okay? Their model, they have 4 everyday outfielders. They have 5 everyday infielders. Obviously, you only need 3 and 4 of those.
Right.
That's really another, let's call it money ball. I don't know, what are we at, 3.0, 4.0 at this point? It's another way that their secret is going to be depth. It's going to allow them to succeed again despite their small payroll and against all odds.
And that was Ben Reiter. He helped Sports Illustrated put together its baseball preview. I want to thank him for being on the show today. Ben, great talking to you.
My pleasure, Mike. Thanks for having me.